Broadcasting.
Thank you. Welcome, everyone. I will call the Joint Committee on Tax Expenditures to order, and we can start by calling the roll.
Senator Finley.
Senator Finley, present by video.
Senator Riley.
Present by video.
Senator Wagner.
Excused.
Co-Vice Chair Boquist.
I believe he's here, but we will enter him excused until we get to the bottom of this.
Okay. Co-Chair Burdick.
Present by video.
Representative Levy.
Present by telephone.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith is present by video.
Representative Valderrama.
Valderrama present by video.
Co-Vice Chair Pham.
Pham is present by video.
Co-Vice Chair Reschke.
Excused.
Co-Chair Nathanson.
Present by video.
Okay, we have four bills on our agenda today, and we will follow that with an informational meeting over the on the tax pass-through issue. So we will start today by opening a public hearing on House Bill 3244 and Senate Bill 43, which deal with the same subject matter.
Right, good afternoon. Respective chairs, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yes, Senate Bill 43 and House Bill 3244 are two bills that are relating to programs for the Film and Video Office. And so Senate Bill 43 is making changes to two programs, extending sunsets on two programs. So the first is the Greenlight Oregon Labor Rebate Program. And this would be a six-year sunset extension from January 1st, 2024 to January 1st, 2030. And the second extension is related to the auction tax credit that also is used for as a funding source through the Film and Video Office. And this is, again, a six-year sunset extension from January 1st, 2024 to January 1st, 2030. And then House Bill 3244 relates to that auction tax credit. Right now, under current law, there is a fiscal year limit of $14 million in tax credits that can be auctioned. And the change in House Bill 3244 would be to increase that limit from $14 million up to $20 million. So again, it's increasing the limit in 3244, and then Senate Bill 43 would extend the sunset on that credit as well.
Okay, we will start off by introducing Representative Noce.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Madam Co-Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Noce. I'm the state representative for House District 42, which is inner southeast Portland and a little sliver of northeast Portland. I will keep my remarks brief about my support for House Bill 3244, which, as you heard, would increase the maximum amount of tax credit for certified film production to $20 million. Colleagues, this tax credit program is not only good for Oregon's economy, but it adds to the rich culture of Oregon's film industry across our whole state. In the final quarter of 2020, the Oregon Film Board reported that while filming the show Top Chef here in Oregon, over $530,000 was spent to rent stage space and $824,000 was spent on hotel rooms. Additionally, the episodes for Top Chef were filmed across the state, meaning that some of the money likely stimulated the economy in some of your districts wherever you reside, in what has been an especially hard year for all of our district's economies. This includes money spent in Hood River, Gerhardt, Clackamas, the Nehalem Bay, Tillamook Bay, Tualatin Turner, and of course, Portland. And this is just the tip of the iceberg, as there are many other shows that have been filmed in Oregon and that are helped stimulating our economy, including Shrill on Hulu, Chad on TBS, The Metal Lords on NFL on Netflix, and The Birch, which is on Facebook Watch. All these shows combined, it is estimated that over $61 million has been spent in Oregon and over 600 jobs have been created. As we work on getting our economy back on track and ensuring that Oregonians are able to work, this being one of the most important focuses of 2021's legislative session, I cannot think of a better time to increase this tax credit for certified film production development in our state. Like I mentioned earlier, the bill not only does amazing things to stimulate our economy, but it adds to a rich sense of culture for our state. Now, I think we're all pretty familiar with Portlandia. For any of my constituents that are tuning in today, I know some of them disagree with its portrayal of Portlanders, but I found that show to be a pretty hilarious and sometimes on-spot, albeit exaggerated, representation of some of the quirky things that people in my area of the world or the state do. If you've never watched the Allergy Pride episode, which this being Pride Month, I highly recommend it, you should watch it as it's hilarious. And I'm a person that has food allergies and I believe a sense of humor. Additionally, I mean, I think some of you know about we're a leading stop motion. Pinocchio is being made here. I could go on and on. So I'll just say this last thing to some of my fellow Democrats who I have sometimes have bristled at tax credits or the sort of tax credit game chasing that we do where we have to offer a tax credit in competition with Texas or another state in order to attract somebody here. And I would just say that, colleagues, until we get governors in the United States to agree in some sort of blood oath that they will stop offering financial tax incentives to industry across the country to come and relocate in there, this is going to be a game that we're going to have to play in periodically. And I think for the investment that we get, for the jobs that this creates, this is one that I enthusiastically support. It works. And with that, Madam Honorable Co-Chairs, that concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much. Senator Smith, or Representative Smith.
That's my brother, Gordon.
Oh, okay. There you got it.
You know, Representative Nose, I want to add to your comments because I think you are spot on. My wife and I enjoy traveling, and whether you're in Argentina or in Iceland or in Hong Kong, Oregon is competing against all these different locations that are offering tax credits, tax incentives, tax rebates, and the list goes on. And there's no doubt about it in my mind as someone who does economic development that the film and movie industry or film and TV industry brings significant economic gain compared to the expense that we may have to endure. And so, Rep. Nose, I'm really pleased you brought this forward. I think the economics are very sound for the state of Oregon. I think there's a good return on investment. So thank you for your leadership.
Thank you very much, Representative Smith. I learned on this committee when I was on it a few years ago that sometimes a tax credit is actually a more efficient way to make an investment and something we want to incentivize. They just have to be evaluated like we evaluate budgets.
Well, and like yes, you, as you said, Representative Nose, if you could get the governors to sign a blood oath, but the way things work now is there is a line on their form when they decide where to go. And the line is for a tax incentive. And we have to have something to put on that line. And because of the, we'll be hearing in a moment from Tim Williams, but because of the way this program has been managed, we get a lot of bang for our buck compared to some of the subsidies that other states are offering. So, and we will be hearing more about that. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you, Representative Nose. We'll let you get back out the sunshine.
Nice to see all of you.
Okay,
bye-bye. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. Next, we'll call Tim Williams.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Hopefully you can see and hear me okay. Chairs Nathanson and Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Tim Williams, and I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Film for the State Film and Media Economic and Development Office. I previously testified on the separate committees on these bills, so I'll try not to repeat myself and be as brief as possible. The slides I've used on previous testimonies, as well as an updated economic development report in our industry, are available on OLIS as part of these bills. I'm here to talk in support of these two bills, SB 43 and HB 3244. SB 43 is an out-of-cycle request to extend the sunset dates for both of our main incentive programs, the Oregon Production Investment Fund and the Greenlight Oregon Labor Rebate Program, by a further 6 years. Both of these programs are cash rebates for production spending on film, television, animation, post-production, and interactive work being done here in the state. They are incentives that are paid out only after the work is done and the spending is verified via audit. This is an out-of-cycle request for an extension is being made in order to preserve a multi-year program that is utilized to retain and attract projects whose production timelines span multiple years. HB 3244 would expand the funding for the Oregon Production Investment Fund, or OPIF, from $14 million per year to $20 million per year. This increase would allow us to retain and capture more work and projects that are currently being lost when our funding is inevitably running out each year. Our project retention and recruitment work is aided by this incentive program, and it focuses on both short-term and long-term productions. But it's the multi-year projects that create the most sustaining economic activity and spending at local businesses. TV series are routinely looking for a five-year program because they want to ensure that a successful series can stay in the chosen location for at least a five-year run. It has been something that has worked well for Oregon in the past few years. This is also true with feature-length animation project, a field, as Rep. Nose noted, is a we have a long history in and a global prominence in producing. Our ability to attract and host multi-year television series has grown extensively over the last several years. We currently have two pilots and a series shooting here right now, while another pilot and two further series are looking to base here in the near future. This is in addition to the three series and two feature films that were shot during the pandemic period. These productions represent multi-year potential for jobs, spending, as well as increased notoriety for the local crews, vendors, locations, and talent. This is specifically highlighted recently in the Oregon-made series Trinkets, garnered seven Emmy nominations, all of which track directly back to local crews. Oregon-based casting, electric, hair, makeup, costume, sound, and art departments were all part of those nominations. There's been a steady upward trend in wages and small business growth directly associated with our industry that in general ties out with the gradual increase of our incentives programs since they were initially introduced in 2005. This is also borne out in the number of productions we work with in every year. In fact, according to various tracking charts I looked at, during this week alone, 17 productions are moving forward here in Oregon. That said, we are still turning away work due to limited funds. Every month, we get numerous calls for productions asking to base here from both local producers and outside companies. Some we have to turn away because our funding runs out. There are many factors that make a production go to another state to shoot, and some end up not shooting at all, but a rough estimation of spending on projects that contact us but end up going elsewhere is in the range of $75 million to $175 million annually. We're currently working to recruit several projects later this year that would more than extinguish our funding for this fiscal year, even before the calendar year ends. HB 3244 represents an increase to our program that both recognizes the growth of this industry and its potential. An increase of this program will also increase the funding for both of our smaller programs that focus on locally produced, lower budgeted work, as well as incentives for regional productions that helped to bring a large Sony film down to Gold Beach this past February, where they spent almost $1 million locally on the ground in Curry County. We hope that you can support HB 43 and HB 3244. I thank you very much for giving me this time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions from the committee. Senator Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tam has heard this several times, but for the new members, I wanted to tell people, I really hate tax credits, but not this one. The reason I don't hate this one is because of the return it actually gives us, much more than what you've heard. When I travel, sometimes I go see the places where the TV series that I love were made. I know that there are people who come to Astoria and other places in Oregon just to see the places where their TV series that they love were made. And that brings in a lot of money that isn't counted in our economic development package that we look at. It's much more than that. So this is a good one. There are a few, not many good tax credits, but there are a few, and this is one of them. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, Tim. Our next witness is, and I apologize in advance for muddling up the name, but Ime Iluke.
That was close. Ime was the first name, and very impressive you got that. last name is Atuk, E-T-U-K. But, wow. thank you for allowing me to be here, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, appreciate the opportunity to speak. I am a Portland born and raised filmmaker, left, started making movies in Los Angeles, did some time in New Orleans before choosing to come back to Portland, Oregon, a place that I was raised and thought was a better place to raise kids than Los Angeles. One of the things that's been great for me with the these tax rebates we're talking about, the extension and the expansion of it is, for me, when I first moved back here, I had to leave a lot to work just because there were only so many projects here. And then in the last 4 to 5 years, I have not had to leave for work. I think it was 2015, 2016. I was away in Washington and in Los Angeles on Twin Peaks for Showtime, the David Lynch series. And while that was a great experience, it was a long time away from my family. And since then, with the Trinkets for Netflix, being a part of that show that won the Emmy Awards, A.D. Bryant, Shrill, Lenistine, Padrats, Chad, Everything Sucks. I mean, so many shows here. And it's been great personally to work in this place that I live, not have to leave my family, and that's been wonderful. In addition to working on those sets as an assistant director, I also have a production company, and am currently in the process of producing a feature film about Portland, as a matter of fact. And with that, you know, one of the first things that we have to do, you know, with a new project, be they big or small, is call the film office and see, is there resources available? And with the expansion of that, it just allows more projects, big and small, to come into play here. The one I'm working on now, one of the beautiful things about that is with that these tax incentives, the ability to help grow the next generation of storytellers, help increase diversity on set in a place that I live by, you know, creating opportunities to see myself reflected on set. And so these have been wonderful for me personally. I see the impact, and for shows that are looking to shoot here in the future, and Tim touched on this, but knowing that if you start a series here, that series can have a home is a really big deal, because, you know, a lot of these shows like Shrill decided to, even though the show was written for Seattle, when they came into Portland, and we shot at Manzanita in different places, but to be able to open the camera up and see the beauty that Oregon has to offer, and know the security that you don't have to change that if your show goes past 3 seasons and you lose the incentive, is a really big deal. So I'm a huge supporter of this, and I just thank you for the opportunity to speak, and happy to answer any questions should there be any. Thank you so much.
And thank you for your comments. Are there any questions? Senator Riley, I still see your hand up. That may be from the previous witness. Hands down. Okay, thank you very much for coming. Our next witness is Fred Ruff.
Hello. Can you guys see me okay?
Yep, you're on camera.
And thank you. And thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to talk with you guys as well. I am a small business owner here in town.
Would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Absolutely. My name is Fred Ruff, and I run a company here in town called Refuge Visual Effects. Coming to town and shooting is a wonderful part of this business. What we do is actually on the backside, which is doing post-production work here in Oregon. So I actually deal mostly in people. I don't deal with camera work, I don't do sets. What I do is I run an office full of computer equipment and people that do visual effects. And I can't tell you how much this program is important to our part of the business. I started my business off when Grimm was in here in town many years ago. And they did 6 seasons here, and I put a small team of people together to help them out with doing some of this post-production, and we've continued to grow over that time. I currently employ about 25 people, and I think in this last year we've done over $1.5 million in salaries, basically, that we do here in the office. Visual effects is a part of the business that involves 3D animation, compositing, and we've recently finished projects like The Underground Railroad, which just came out, that Barry Jenkins has done. Recently, we had Steve Carell on our monitors working on a Netflix show called Space Force, and we've also worked on shows for Marvel TV like Runaways and Hellstrom. We're currently working on 2 Apple TV shows starring Joel Kinnaman and Jason Momoa. And I don't think anybody in town really knows how much work comes from Los Angeles to Oregon to do this kind of work. One of the biggest shows we're working on right now is also Superman and Lois, which is on the CW. When we talk to clients about potentially doing work with us, they really enjoy working with us because we're good to work with. We do a fantastic job, but it always comes down to money. And the first conversation is that they want to take all the work to Canada. They want to go to Vancouver. I can't tell you how many times, even Stumptown, which was supposedly shot in Oregon, was mostly shot in Vancouver. And this work continues to go up to Canada, having the largest tax credits. So the first conversation we have, just having any tax credit at all, gets us in the door to have that conversation. So once we start talking to a client, the first thing we have to do is reach out to Tim Williams and say, hey, is there any money left? Because we don't want to promise this client a discount and then not be able to cash in on it. The cool thing about the program is that that we're a part of is the IOPIF, which gives us a rebate directly back to the Oregon company. And that's intended for us to grow our business even more. And as a small and medium-sized business, it's very important. I want to leave you with a story that just happened to me this last week. We did fantastic through COVID because we are an office-based program, and we can quickly go to working from home, and we kept everybody that we were working with really busy through COVID. The other day, we realized we needed to hire another person, and my team went out there and started looking for candidates and found two fantastic candidates, and I was really struggling between which one of these people I could hire to help my business out, and a light bulb went off in my head, and I looked at my whole team, and I said, guys, did we get rebate money from Oregon this past year? We did. We're going to hire both these people. So with a little bit of like doubling down and a little bit of like kind of putting the money up front, we decided to hire two more people that are from Oregon to help us with our business instead of just picking one. And I think that's exactly what this program is supposed to do. It helps me build out this business. We're going to move to a 10,000 foot place right here in Laurelhurst, probably in about 3 months. And we really hope that we can continue to grow this business and keep people employed and keep them doing amazing stuff. I'm here for any questions if you have anything, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. I love hearing these stories about the behind the scenes workers who really make this industry work in Oregon. I know that it's been a goal all along to really draw the post-production world here, and just thrilled to hear about your success.
Thank you again.
Are there other questions from the committee? I see no questions. Thank you very much. Our next witness is Kyle Thomas.
Yes, good afternoon, Chair Burdick. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Kyle Thomas. I'm Director of Legislative and Policy Affairs for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and I'm here to testify on House Bill 3244. I want to start by saying I don't want my comments to be construed in any way as opposing the bill, and I'm not here today to argue that this tax credit and the program it funds are not valuable economic development tools. I'm here today because the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the state's largest financial aid program serving over 30,000 low-income Oregon students who attend state colleges and universities, also issues tax credits to fund a portion of its financial aid awards. And in doing so, we're friendly competitors of the Oregon film in a market that in recent history has purchased all of the available credits. We entered the tax credit market with the passage of Senate Bill 1528 in 2018, and since then have sold our entire allotment of $14 million worth of credits. With the change in federal tax treatment of these credits, we've seen the value of bids decline from selling at over face value to an average of about $40 less than face value. So even though we sell $14 million in credits, we capture closer to $12 million in revenue. In addition, instead of hosting one auction period to sell our full allotment of credits, in 2019, we needed two auctions to do so due to weaker demand. Though the credits were initially, at least according to the proponent of the original measure, designed to be additive to the state CSL budget for the Opportunity Grant, the budget for the current biennium utilized these dollars in order to maintain the Opportunity Grant at a level near CSL. The consequence is that, at least in our current budget cycle, these are dollars we consider core to the operation of the financial aid program at historical levels. by increasing the credits Oregon Film may sell, and because both Oregon Film and HEC sell credits in the same market, there is an increased risk that any softening in the market demand for these credits could impact the funding available for student grants in the state. Looking at the most recent tax year, this would not have been an issue. If Oregon Film sold $20 million in credits as provided by this bill and HEC sold $14 million, there was still an additional $4.5 million of demand for these credits. But 2020 was a very good year for markets, possibly leading to an increased demand for these credits to offset capital gains, and this may not always be the case. If financial aid in Oregon were well-funded, I would likely not be here asking you to consider the interactions between our two programs as you debate the bill, but financial aid in Oregon is severely underfunded. From 2009 to 2019, 2 million opportunity grant applications were filed, and the state provided OOG awards to only 16.5% of those students. Two of our border states, Washington and California, each provide about three times as much financial aid as we do in Oregon on a per student basis. And the Oregon Opportunity Grant does not even serve every student qualified for a federal Pell Grant. In this decade, where 97% of new above average wage jobs will require a post-secondary credential, this is both an economic development and an equity issue. And so the commission's request today is that as you consider this bill, please do so while being cognizant of the relationship it does have to state financial aid, and do what you're able to support mitigating any potential revenue loss for student grants and to support adequate and increased funding for the state opportunity grant. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? I see no questions. Thank you. And I believe that completes our witness list. Haley, are we, is any late signups or are we done?
We are done, Chair Burnett.
Okay, thank you. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3244 and Senate Bill 43 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2096.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2096, this is a bill related to an existing tax credit, the Agricultural Workforce Housing Tax Credit, and it was a bill that was introduced at the request of the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. And what it does is it's making an adjustment or making a change to the tax credit and the limit on the tax credit that's in place in current law. So as of right now, there is a limit on the tax credits per year of $3.625 million. And the change in House Bill 2096 would be to increase that limit and make it a biannual limit. So rather than being an annual limit, it would be a biannual limit. And that new limit per biennium would be $16.75 million. So that's an increase over the biennium of $9.5 million. And this would take, it would take effect January 1st, 2022.
Thank you. Our first witnesses to sign up are Julie Cody and Margaret Salazar. And which of you would like to go first?
Good afternoon, co-chairs Nathanson and Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm executive director of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today. We are here today asking for your support of House Bill 2096, which, as you heard, would be an increase to the agricultural worker housing tax credit. This is a proven state income tax credit given to those who incur costs to construct, install, acquire, or rehabilitate housing for the agricultural workforce so critical to Oregon's economy. What a year 2020 was, and we're still having. So many communities have faced hardship after hardship, and it's hard to think of a population more impacted than our agricultural workers. It goes without question that agricultural workers are among the most essential workers in our state. And when COVID hit, farm workers couldn't work from home. Our agricultural workers are on the front lines during this pandemic, working to provide food for Oregon's families and to help fuel Oregon's economy. They have been disproportionately impacted. And I know this committee knows very well that while we were struggling with that impact, the wildfires tore through our state and working conditions worsened with hazardous and smoky air. In Representative Marsh's district, the agricultural worker community was again disproportionately impacted. As we look ahead towards an equitable economic recovery for the state, the needs of this essential workforce must be front and center. House Bill 2096 begins that recovery. It increases the agricultural worker housing tax credit and makes important programmatic changes. An increase of $9.5 million to the credit would enable the development of approximately 240 new homes for the next biennium. As you heard from the experts at the Legislative Revenue Office, the American Rescue Plan Act has a provision that impacts your ability to allocate tax credit resources. This committee has some tough decisions, but we believe in the wake of 2020, now is the time to address the urgent need for better housing conditions. Not only does House Bill 2096 support Oregon's essential workers, it also ensures that the agricultural industry has the needed housing for its workforce. Director of Affordable Rental Housing at OHCS, Julie Cody, will explain the tax credit mechanics and the details of the bill. And then after she has a chance to testify, we would be happy to answer your questions. I'll turn things over now to Director Cody.
Thank you. Welcome, Director Cody. Julie Cody, are you with us?
Sorry, having trouble with my mute button.
Okay.
Thank you, co-chairs Nathanson and Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Julie Cody, and I'm the Director of Affordable Rental Housing at Oregon Housing and Community Services. As Executive Director Salazar spoke to, the Agricultural Worker Housing Tax Credit is used by farmers and community organizations in developing affordable, safe homes. It is a state income tax credit given to those who incur costs to construct, install, acquire, or rehabilitate housing for the agricultural workforce. This program has supported developments across the state, from Madras to Ashland, Sandy to Forest Grove, and many places in between. The state tax credit can be taken on 50% of the eligible costs actually paid or incurred to complete an agricultural worker housing project. These tax credits can be transferred to a contributor or investor of the project, which is a strategy used by nonprofit developers. These credits are often sold to their lenders or in community developments as part of a larger financing package. Owners of these developments are required to provide housing to agricultural workers and their families for at least 10 years. The vast majority, around 80%, of agricultural worker housing tax credits are used for in-community developments. Nonprofits often pair these resources with standard development resources provided by OHCS that come with affordability covenants, meaning that the rents must be affordable to low-income people for a defined time period, usually beyond the 10 years. Required by this credit. Historically, OHCS has administered the Agricultural Worker Tax Credit annually on a first-come, first-served basis. House Bill 2096 would provide OHCS the flexibility to administer the program annually or every other year. This allows OHCS to pair the tax credit with other development resource offerings, meaning housing developers could apply for this state tax credit at the same time that they are applying for other state and federal development resources administered by Oregon Housing and Community Services. The bill also provides for technical edits, confirming the term agricultural worker is used in statute instead of farm worker. Last and certainly not least, House Bill 2096 increases the agricultural worker housing tax credit by $9.5 million a biennium for a total of $16.75 million a year, increases it by $9.5 million for a total of $16.75 million for the whole biennium. This is a chronically oversubscribed resource. Given the recent crises faced by the communities, by this community, the investment is timely and will meet a longstanding need. Agricultural Worker Housing Tax Credit is a proven program used to develop and rehab safe, affordable housing for Oregon's agricultural workers and their families, both on-farm and in-community. It's chronically oversubscribed, and in the wake of 2020, now is the time to address this urgent need. Not only does this investment support Oregon's essential workers, it also ensures the agriculture industry has the needed housing for their workforce. I hope OHCS can count on your support for House Bill 2096. Thank you for your time and consideration. With that, Executive Director Salazar and I are available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for either of these witnesses? Thank you very much. Our next witness is Peter Hanley.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. My name is Peter Hanley. I'm Executive Director of CASA of Oregon. For the last 32 years, we've been utilizing this credit to build farm worker housing, agricultural workforce housing throughout the state. We believe that the total number of farm workers and their families that have been housed with this tax credit approximates 10,000, yet it's estimated that it's less than 5% of the total need that is out there for the farm workers and their families. Given the recent events of COVID and the wildfires, we've also seen a lot of displacement of farm workers. And in fact, one project down in Jackson County that was specifically for farm workers was burnt in the fires. This tax credit, when it was passed in 1989, specifically came with a policy that accompanied the legislation, stating that it was the policy of the state to ensure that we provide safe, decent, and affordable housing for farm workers. And so this tax credit has been doing that for 32 years. CASA develops primarily community-based housing, but we've also assisted farmers in the past in helping them either renovate their housing or to build new housing. There are adequate mechanisms for compliance to ensure that farm workers continue living in this housing, as well as ensuring that the housing is maintained in good order. I'm hoping that, as Senator Riley said, this is one of the good tax credits. I'm going to assume it's one of the good tax credits, and that the tax credit that's coming up behind this, which is the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, which we also use for farm worker projects, as well as for our resident-owned co-op conversion of manufactured housing parks, that today is good tax credit day, and that you guys will look favorably upon both of these tax credits. I'd be more than happy to take any questions, and thank you for your support of this bill, the following bill, and thanks for your service to the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? I see no questions, so thank you. Our last witness is Annabelle, and I don't see a last name.
Hi.
Annabelle Hernandez.
Annabelle Hernandez, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. My whole name is Anabel Hernandez Mejia. I am the resident leadership coordinator for Farm Worker Housing Development Corporation. And as representative of FHDC, we are thankful for the funding that the Agricultural Worker Housing Tax Credit is offered by OHCS. And while FHDC has been able to provide housing for 1,500 individuals with 340 units, 140 more coming in this image you see back here in Lebanon, still, I work directly with the residents. And as was stated previously, the pandemic has been hard. Farm workers has been one of the groups that were mostly affected, but even without the pandemic, it is hard. And these funds allow us as an organization to develop the farm workers and their families, from being able to provide schools, summer programs to improve grades, graduation rates, and also those students going into careers, college. We also promote healthy habits. And one of our more recent programs has been the Promotores Comunitarios program, which is a program that's focused in capacity building and leadership. And just in our pilot year, we were able to have 3 of the 7 participants go out of the field and get a job. One of them was hired with a school district. 2 others were hired with different organizations. And in less than the 2 years, 2 other ones were able to get a raise in their own work. So although the tax credit does not fund these programs directly, they do create the foundation in which we're able to base off to create these programs and create these development in obviously healthier families, communities in which everybody can prosper. And with that, I thank you. And thank you also for your consideration.
Thank you. And I really like your background back there. Are there questions? Senator Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I wanted to ask if, obviously this is a transferable tax credit since you probably have no taxes to pay being an organization that is a nonprofit. How much do you have to discount these tax credits when you sell them?
That question would be most appropriate for the executive director. My specialty is working directly one-on-one with the residents, their needs. So all the numbers and accounting tends to go off to other members. I can have them contact you, though, for your specific question.
So is one of the other people who testified available to maybe answer that question?
I would invite Julie Cody or Peter Hanley to answer that question as the experts.
Sure. So when we get an allocation, when the project gets an allocation of tax credits from the state, we then put a proposal together, send them out to the banks or to private investors, to CPAs, whoever, to get some bids on it. And depending on the year, what current tax policy is at the federal government, it can be anywhere from 70 to 80, 81 cents. I would remind you that this is a tax credit that covers a span of 5 years. You know, there is obviously risk involved with any sort of construction project or investment in tax credits. And I guess the only other thing I would add, and I haven't looked at the tax expenditure report lately, but I know that the credits being claimed and the credits awarded, that folks aren't claiming the credits at a rate that one would think they should be. And so I don't know if one of the fiscal staff there could follow up on that. But that typically they're selling anywhere from, you know, 75 to 81 cents.
Okay. Chris or someone, could you fill in the gap there about how much we're paying out from these?
Kyle, why don't you take that question?
Yeah, Senator Riley, in terms of the credits, the tracking on this is definitely improving on how we can track the credits claim, because this credit is set up to be taken over at minimum 5 years, and then there's a carry forward, and so it can be quite extensive of trying to track when a credit is initially claimed, as we would say, and then when it's actually used to reduce tax liability. And for that reason, I don't really have a great answer for you at this time. We do have some new tracking of the data going forward that's just started in the last most recent years, where we start to see who's carrying these credits forward. But the last time I worked with this data over the past few years, it was really hard and difficult to try to true these up with when the credit was initially claimed and then how much actually gets taken and when. And part of that is just because the span of this can be well over 10 years when these credits get claimed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's really good information to be able to have. If we're not getting the money to the projects that we're paying out, I think we need to start looking at a different way to do it. In the meantime, I'm in favor of these two tax credits, but I think we ought to be looking at other ways to fund projects that don't involve putting the future legislature in charge of paying for them.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Like Senator Riley, I strongly support both of these tax credits. I do want to highlight something, though, and I do this with all due respect to our presenters. Where I come from in this era of cultural sensitivity, the term farm worker is a term of respect. It's a term of honor. And so out where we are, our farm workers are partners with everyone in agriculture. And so I hope no one would feel uneasy about calling one of our fellow human beings a farm worker, because it's honorable work. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for pointing that out. Okay, other questions from the committee? I see no questions, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2096 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2584.
Okay, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2584 is continuing with the theme of related to tax credits of housing. In this case, it's an existing tax credit, the Affordable Housing Lenders Tax Credit. And what the change being made, or the changes being made in House Bill 2584, the first is relating to, again, there's an existing law limit on the outstanding amount of credits that can exist in any fiscal year. And that, under current law, is $25 million, and House Bill 2584 would increase that to $35 million. And again, this is a limit on the outstanding amount of tax credits that can be used. Currently, we are under that limit, though there has been an increase in use of the credit, and some of the concern is the potentially hitting that cap in the coming years. Other changes are really related to programmatic changes about really trying to encourage or align the incentive here in 2584, the credit, with other housing incentives and programs that can support this type of construction. So again, those are the programmatic changes, and it would apply to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2022.
Thank you. So we'll start with Jonathan Trutt, and that will be followed by Peter Hanley and Doug Christman. So Jonathan, are you here?
I am. Are you able to hear me and see me?
We are, yes.
Okay, great. Thank you, Co-Chairs Burdick and Nathanson and members, for this opportunity to provide public testimony in support of HB 2584. For the record, my name is Jonathan Trutt. I am the Director of Real Estate Development at Home Forward, and we are Multnomah County's housing authority. So we serve 15,000 households in Multnomah County via our affordable apartments and our Section 8 voucher program. And I have about 15 years of affordable housing development work here in Oregon. Prior to being at the Housing Authority, I was at Northwest Housing Alternatives, which has a statewide presence in affordable housing and resident services. And I'm here to testify in favor of HB 2584. I can say that across the 15 years that I've been working here in the state, I've had the opportunity at the organizations I work at to utilize Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits both for new construction and for the preservation of affordable housing with federal rental subsidy, or Section 8. And in both cases, it's really an incredibly powerful tool that complements federal resources and enables us to provide high quality, deeply affordable housing. Very briefly, there are actually, on the rental side, I'll say, two ways that project sponsors use OAHTC. So in the new construction setting, what it does is it brings the rents down. And so I'll talk through a project very quickly as an example. We have an effort going right now that's a partnership with Portland Community College to jointly redevelop a 3-acre site that PCC owns in Northeast Portland. And the idea is to co-locate a new workforce training center and affordable housing. So there'll be 84 apartments that we will own on that site, ranging from studios all the way up to 3 bedrooms. And as a mission-driven developer and owner, we always want to get the rents as affordable as possible. And with OAHTC, we're able to charge hundreds of dollars less per month than would otherwise be necessary on many of the units to make the project financially viable. To put a little more detail to it, 20 of the apartments out of the overall 84 are going to have rents that are about 1/3 of what market rate rents are in the neighborhood. So for example, that translates to studios that rent for $386 a month. And so if you're a senior or a person with disabilities on a fixed income, that is a lot better than the $1,200 a month studios that we're seeing built right now, or other apartments that are certainly more affordable than that, but not what you could do on, say, $1,200 or $1,400 a month. So bottom line is that these lower rents make a real difference for our residents who are working hard to balance food, housing, childcare, medical, and transportation costs. In the preservation context, we are, my gosh, really almost a full decade into the process of renovating our public housing portfolio of about 2,500 homes. And we've been doing this in bundles. We've been doing this in partnership with Oregon Housing and Community Services. Many of the residents who live in these apartment buildings are seniors and persons with disabilities. Most have incomes between $10,000 and $15,000 a year. And we've been able, through the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, to tackle the kind of building systems that for years, as the federal government disinvested in public housing, we just, even with the best preventative maintenance, couldn't get to, because much of this housing is 50 years old. So we've had the opportunity through using OAHDC to replace water lines, completely replace siding and windows, modernize elevators, make significant improvements to building lobbies, and most importantly to the residents for whom these apartments are home, to their unit interiors with new flooring, new cabinets, new appliances. We've been able to vastly improve the community space in our buildings, and that came in very handy because in the last couple of months, we've been running vaccination clinics for the residents in those improved lobby spaces, all of which has been made possible by Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits. My last point is that if I go back a few years to my time at Northwest Housing Alternatives, Northwest Housing Alternatives has done a lot of federally subsidized affordable housing preservation around the state. So all over the state, Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits have been ensuring that that our neighbors have high quality homes, both now and in future generations. And I know when I was at NHA, we were working using Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits in Hermiston, Milwaukee, Medford, Bend, Florence, Corvallis, and Portland. So the benefits of this program are really spread statewide. With that, I appreciate your time, and I'm happy to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Questions? I see no questions, so thank you very much. Our next witness is Douglas Christman.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Doug Christman, owner of Christman Development, a development company located in Enterprise, Oregon, that specializes in preserving rural properties, generally financed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We have preserved, using the OAHTC, the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits, around 1,400 units the tax credit is critical for making the financing work and leveraging all the other federal resources that could be lost if these projects were to come out of the program and prepay, which most of them have been at risk, and there's still a lot of those properties at risk. And the fixes that they're putting in to this bill would greatly enhance our ability to utilize the credit more effectively, because with the Department of Agriculture, they require a 30-year loan term, and the tax credit currently only goes for 20, which requires us to fund a reserve account to help pay that loan payment down at year 20, which is a little awkward. Anyway, I'll keep it brief. I'm not much of a public speaker, but this is preserving and leveraging the federal funds really seems to make a lot of sense. And I urge your support for this bill. And if anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? I see no questions, so we will go to our last witness, Peter Hanley.
Good afternoon again, Madam Co-Chairs and Vice Chairs and members of the committee. Peter Hanley, Executive Director of CASA of Oregon. I mentioned that we have utilized this tax credit on farmworker projects. I think more importantly, on our resident-owned manufactured housing cooperative conversion program, it's really important. Of the 18 parks that have been converted, 13 have utilized the OHTC. If I could use one example, a park we recently converted in Portland, 27 spaces, all residents had incomes below 50% of the area median. Without the OHTC, they were looking at $160 a month rent increases. With the tax credits, we were able to reduce that increase to only $45 a month. And that was really what made the resident purchase really a reality. Right now, we've got two parks, one in Newport that represents about 4% of the state's population, also includes a large number of RVs, which, as we know, a lot of homeless or near homeless people are living in. That park, while we're just bridging the purchase for now, we're going to need Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits for that purchase. The other park that we're working on right now is in Springfield, the Patrician, which is a park that about 2 years ago had a land use action which changed the zoning to commercial. So it's very valuable for an investor to potentially close that park down. We're also going to be bridging that one, looking for Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits to help us with that purchase, as well as hoping for some gap funding from the state. So I would urge you to pass House Bill 2584. And once again, thank you for your service. And this, again, is one of those good tax credits.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, I see no questions. And that is the end of our witness list. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2584. And our next item of business is a informational hearing on some of the pass-through tax revisions that Senator Boquist and I have been working on this session. We will be presenting those in public hearing at the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee next Monday. But I wanted, since we have the opportunity to get both committees together, I thought it would be good to have an informational meeting on what we're talking about here. And basically, it goes back to 2013 when we established the pass-through tax break for that was aimed at encouraging small businesses to grow and encouraging people to employ more people. And over the years, with our experience, we made the program probably too lenient, and we ended up subsidizing a lot of people who already had a lot of wealth. And we wanted to look at ways that we could narrow the program back down so it gets closer to our real objectives of encouraging small business and encouraging investment back into businesses. So with that, and Senator Boquist, I just don't see him here. I would love to hear his introductory comments, but he's had some technical difficulties. But this is a product that we have worked together on in a bipartisan way, and I think you'll see the results of that. So Chris, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, this is, Kyle's going to be doing the presentation, but what we were able to do is Kyle spent a lot of time over at the Department of Revenue exploring data that were available on the tax returns to support and inform the policy decisions that the chair and the vice chair were discussing.
Yes, and I can't say enough about Kyle's work. We thought for a while that he had actually disappeared at the Department of Revenue because he spent many hours really digging into the data to figure out how this program is really working, and it's been invaluable in terms of guiding us to changes that will preserve the original intent and still kind of weed out some of the people that we really did not intend this to benefit. So Kyle, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, for the introduction. And yeah, so I do have following up on some of the proposed changes, and I guess giving away some of the changes that will be coming out on Senate Bill 139 next week in Senate Finance and Revenue. I do have an overview of the existing program and then a few slides that will walk through some of those proposed changes and then what the outcome is for the taxpayers and the business entities that are in the program today, or what we'd expect those outcomes to be by making these proposed changes. So there are some slides, and I'll get my screen shared here in just a moment, but they are available in the meeting materials. Again, these will be in the meeting materials under the meeting itself, not under any particular bill, because it is an informational hearing. Okay, so let me get this shared and then make this a little bit bigger. Hopefully everybody can see it here. Okay, so again, yeah, just overview of what's going to be covered today. Again, a review of the existing policy. Both the committees, both the House and the Senate revenue committees, have heard about this policy earlier in this session, so I'll try not to go into too much detail over the existing policy other than to help set up what the proposed changes are. And then following the proposed changes, then have those potential effects on of each of the individual proposed changes, then how that all fits together and what we think a revenue impact would be going forward if these changes were adopted. So in terms of the existing pass-through entity or the PTE income program, this again is related to pass-through businesses and sole proprietorships. So this is gonna be your S-corps, partnerships, and your sole proprietors. And the way that these are set up, the reason they're referred to as pass-through entities is that the income itself, the profit, if you will, from the business entity is passed through to the owners. So that could be the partners, or in the case of S-corps, that would be the shareholders. So the profit from the business is actually passed through to the owners, and that income then shows up or gets reported on the personal income tax returns. So it's business income that then passes through and shows up on the individual income tax returns. And the simplest way to describe it is it's business income minus business expenses. And what you're left with is profit, and that profit is what gets passed through. So again, the program that we're talking about here does relate to S-corps, partnerships, and sole proprietors. However, one thing I would say at the beginning here is the proposed changes do not affect sole proprietors. The proposed changes are related to S-corps and partnerships, which do make up the lion's share of the program. But just to put that out front, sole proprietors are not part of the proposed changes going forward. But in terms of existing policy requirements right now, the first one on the individual level is an owner, in this case, to receive these reduced tax rates. On this income, the taxpayer or the owner must materially participate in the business. And what that means is they just need to be active in the business. So you can think of it, you might have two different types of owners. One that's a passive investor, they put some money into the business, but they're not actively involved in it. And another one that's actively involved in operating the business. Maybe they're working there or what have you, but they are participating in the ongoing operations of the business, and that's the first qualification for the individuals. They have to be materially participating. And the requirements on the business entity are, there's really one, or you can think of it as two, or one that's related, has two components, but it's the first is the business entity. So in this case, we'd be talking the partnership or the S-corp or the sole proprietorship, has to have at least one full-time non-investor employee. So that means they have to employ at least one individual that's not an owner of one of these businesses. And there's requirements of 1,200 in aggregate hours of work and 30 hours per week work to be counted as this employee. So it's focused on one full-time employee, really. But those are really the requirements, is participation and then employ one person. So again, just try to keep this brief. The benefit here is a reduced rates. So what you see here on the left side, these are the joint income tax rates and brackets that we have. These are your standard rates on the personal income tax side. And then over here is the reduced rates for this non-passive income. So this pass-through income, rather than say hitting the being taxed at the 9.9% tax rate, which would be our top, Oregon's top tax rate, it would be taxed at beginning at 7% and then ranging back up to that 9%. And that depends upon the amount of income being passed through. So this taxable income, this the first $250,000 in this pass-through income is taxed at 7%. Amount from $250,000 to $500,000 is at 7.2%. So these are marginal rates. And they work their way up until they reach that 9.9%. So income above $5 million passed through to the individual taxpayer is taxed at that same 9.9%. But anything below that potentially benefits from these reduced rates. The table you have here is just the revenue impact of the pass-through program for the last 5 years. And you can see in the most recent 2019, these numbers are still preliminary, but it was about $125 million was the reduction from these reduced rates. Okay, so moving to the proposed changes. What I have here is this is a chart showing the proposed changes that will be in Senate Bill 139. And the way I've set this up, this is just a chart showing all the changes together, and then I'll step through these one at a time and give a little more detail on each of the individual changes on later slides. So I just try to put it all together in one slide for you. But again, the current law, I've set this up, you have the individual taxpayer, the requirement right now, again, is that material participation. For S-corps and partnerships, again, it's that, I described it earlier, the one full-time employee that's a non-owner. And that's the same requirements then exist for the sole proprietors as well. They have to have that one employee with the 1,200 hours, 30 hours per week. So the proposal that's being discussed here, I tried to set this up again. The first change would be a reduction in the first two rates, or it's really a change to the brackets and the reduction of those first two, or the second two, or two of the rates, excuse me, to the bracket rates. And I have a chart on this that I'll go into more detail in just a second. So there'd be a slight reduction in the rates, those pass-through rates. And the next set of changes really point back to the business entity. So in this case, again, sole proprietors are not part of this new change. So what would be potentially affected are the S-corps and the partnerships. And so the first change here, you can almost think that there's maybe two changes, or again, three changes, where one of them is interconnected with the other. But the first change relates to the ordinary business income of the pass-through entity. So this would be focusing on the S-corp, focusing on the business. So the ordinary business income is the terminology that gets used in the tax system. You can think of that's pretty much the same thing as profit. Okay, ordinary business income is the profit of the business entity for that year. So if a business entity, S-corp or partnership, has profit above $5 million in the year, they would no longer be, their income that they're passing through would no longer be able to qualify for those reduced rates. So if there's a partnership with five partners and that partnership itself, that business, let's say has profit of $6 million for the year, that income that they pass through to those five partners cannot be used against the reduced rates. So it's basically saying if you're making a profit above $5 million, that business entity, that income that's passed through does not qualify for the reduced rates. So that's the first change. The second one is relating to the business entities. They have to meet one or both of these the following two requirements. So you have to meet one, or you can meet both and still qualify, but you have to meet at least one of these new proposed changes. And the first is relating to the number of employees to the number of Oregon owners. So it's Oregon employees to Oregon owners. And the idea here is, and again, I'll get into more detail in just a second, but as a business becomes more profitable, as that ordinary business income increases, the ratio of Oregon employees to Oregon owners is required to increase. So the idea being, as a business becomes more profitable, they're required to employ more individuals to continue to qualify for the reduced rates. Now, the second possibility here is, well, if you don't meet the owner or the employee to owner ratio, you can still meet a secondary requirement, which relates to distributions of income. And it's probably easier to think of this as a reinvestment requirement, where the business entity is required to reinvest 75% of that profit back into the business. And this is, again, I'll have more detail on this, but this is taken, this is based upon a three-year average. But so if a business, if they're not employing enough individuals to qualify for that on the employment ratio requirement, but that business entity is reinvesting more than 75% of their profit back into the business, then they could qualify for these reduced rates. And one thing to keep in mind here is with this proposal, it doesn't make a change to the employee of one full-time non-owner. So at minimum, that existing requirement doesn't change. So even if a business is reinvesting a sufficient amount of their profits, they still have to employ at least one individual. So they still have to meet the same requirement that's in law today, but they may not have to meet that ratio requirement that is employees to owners. So just touching on the rate changes. So the two proposed rate changes have to do with the second and third bracket. So the first one is that tax rate at 7.2% would be reduced to 7%. And it's done by combining these two brackets into one. So it's basically the income that's passed through that's less than $500,000 would now be subject to that 7% rate. And then for pass-through income that's in 500,000 to 1 million, that would be subject to 7.5% rather than 7.6%. And so the business, or the, in this case, we're focused on the individual taxpayers that are receiving this income. For those that have over 250,000 in this pass-through income, they would benefit from these rates, at least from the 7% and then possibly from the 7.5%. That represents about 20% of all individuals using these reduced rates today would benefit from these rate reductions being proposed. So the limit on ordinary business income, again, this is the $5 million limit. This is the first of the new changes. Again, this is talking about, I'll use the term profit, though in statute it would be written as ordinary business income. But for those entities that are above $5 million in profit for the year, they would no longer, their income would not qualify as being passed through. And so the chart you have here is just showing, well, in terms of the number of entities, so here is the category of this ordinary business income, this profit amount, those at 5 million or above, in terms of number of entities, it's only about 1%. So it's a very small number of businesses that are making a profit over $5 million. However, because they are a highly profitable business, they're passing through a lot more income. That represents about 22% of the income being passed through from partnerships or S-corps. So again, these are the highly profitable businesses, so they're passing through more of that income, and more of that income then gets applied to those reduced rates. So by eliminating those that are in the profit above 5 million, you'd eliminate only about 1% of the business entities, but that would account for about 22% of that income. So it definitely accounts for a greater amount of the revenue impact going forward. And I'll get to that a little bit more in just a few slides. The Oregon employee to Oregon owner ratio, I mentioned this earlier, the change here, and this is focused on Oregon employees and Oregon owners, and it would be a ratio that would have to be maintained by the business. They'd have to meet or exceed it in order to qualify for the program. And so this employee to owner ratio is based upon the profit of the business. So the greater the amount of profit, the more employees to owners that business entity is required to have. So for those that have profit less than 500,000, it would be a 1-to-1 ratio. So if this is a business that has one owner, they would be required to have one employee. And that's really no change from the current law. But let's say it's a partnership or an S corp with five owners, they would then need to employ five employees. And that's the key change here is under current law, it's simply one employee. That's the only requirement. The change here is going, well, now it's a ratio to the number of owners you have and the number of individuals you're employing. But again, the takeaway here is as you become more profitable, you are required to employ more individuals. And by the time you get to that 2.5 million to 5 million in profit, it's a 10-to-1 ratio, employees to owner. And the chart over here on the right is just showing, well, how many of those, when we look at past years, how many of these businesses would meet this ratio today? And we see overall, it's about 87%, based upon what they're reporting right now on their tax returns, about 87% would meet this requirement today, with about 13% failing to meet that requirement. And again, that starts with those, the less profitable businesses, the smaller businesses. About 88% are meeting that ratio. As you move down and go to the more profitable entities, again, this ratio of employees to owners goes up. We are seeing those that meet the ratio go down. So as you're required to have more employees, we would be expecting businesses at the higher profits to be less likely to qualify. Now, in terms of the, so the second test then is this profit reinvestment requirement. And again, the way it's written right now is it's limiting distributions as a percentage of profit less than 25%. Again, it's probably easier said another way. It's probably easier to think of this. A business then is required to reinvest 75% of their profit back into the business. And if they do that, then they would meet this requirement, and then they're not required to meet that employee to owner ratio because they only have to meet one of these two. They can meet them both, but if they meet one of these two, if they meet the employee requirement, then they qualify, or if they meet this reinvestment requirement, they would qualify. And I have a similar table here, and you can just see the reinvestment requirement. There are less businesses that are expected to meet this reinvestment requirement going forward. Again, on the previous slide, it was about 87% were meeting the employer requirement. Here overall, it's about 24% that are meeting this reinvestment requirement. And as you move up with those business entities that have more in profit, they are less likely to meet this reinvestment, which means they are dispersing more of their profit to their individual owners. So in terms of overall, what's the effective changes of layering these? We have the rate changes that affects the individual taxpayers, but the new proposal, the $5 million limitation on profit, and then the requirement of the employee to owner or the reinvestment requirement, what does that mean in the end for these business entities? And overall, we're expecting about 90% would continue to qualify. So they're meeting that employer requirement or they're meeting that reinvestment requirement. And this includes that those that are 5 million or above are simply out of the program. If you have profits over 5 million, regardless of your employer reinvestment, you're not allowed to utilize these reduced rates when you pass through that income. So again, it's about 10% we expect not to qualify, but that does represent about 66% would continue to qualify. So that leaves about 34% of this income that's passed through would no longer qualify for these reduced rates. And that's the key there. Again, it's because much of the focus is on this 5 million or above, which accounts for about 66% of the overall change here, is just that $5 million limitation. We do see that by reducing the number of businesses that qualify by 10%, that does account for about 34% reduction in the pass-through income that would qualify. So in terms of final takeaways, the numbers we looked at, it's about 20,000 S-Corp partnerships have income that they pass through for these reduced rates. And we'd expect about 10% of those, or 2,000, would not qualify under the new proposal going forward. Again, it's about I didn't talk about much of the impact, or the majority of the impact does come from that $5 million in profit limitation. In terms of number of taxpayers, we would expect this to be about 3,500 to 4,500 individual taxpayers. And again, this can be as an individual business entity can, of course, pass through income to multiple owners. It doesn't just have to be one owner. One business could have maybe five owners, 10 owners, something along those lines. The final net impact that we're expecting, this would be a positive revenue lift of about 30 to 40 million over the next, per year in the next coming biennium. So initially we're looking in the lower $30 million range. And then as this program grows, we're looking getting closer to that $40 million amount in the later years. But again, that's the takeaway here of these proposed changes. Wanted to give you some sense of where we are with the revenue impact. Of course, we'd be fitting the final numbers, not necessarily the rounded numbers that you have here, to any proposal that you would see at the committee level. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. That was excellent, Kyle. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, and we still don't have Senator Boquist available, is that correct? Okay. just a couple of comments on the, Kyle mentioned the investment criterion that you can get into the program if you meet a pretty high investment ratio. And that was actually put in at the suggestion of Larry George, who is one of the negotiators of the original program, who said, you know, sometimes with the small, with the smallest businesses that are just getting started, that they might not be able to meet the employee threshold, but they're putting every dime back into the business. So that was an effort to really accommodate the very smallest businesses that we have, which of course, as they grow, then they have an increasing employee to owner ratio. I think it's really key, and I don't know, it's hard to imagine how we did this in the first place, but having a simple requirement of one non-owner employee for an entire business was way, way, way too lenient. And I feel that what we've done here is much more realistic in terms of the taxpayers, the other taxpayers getting the benefit of this tax break for S-Corps and partnerships. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I was asked a question from a member who is not able to be here. Representative Reschke had an emergency and can't be here. The fundamental question was what would be the impact on the kicker, and I believe that Mr. Alanak has an even more fine-tuned version of the question, but could Kyle or Mr. Easton or Mr. Alanak please address what impact there is on the kicker, and depending on what year this starts.
Sure, Madam Co-Chair. It doesn't really affect the kicker, like this biennium's kicker. What it will do is for the next biennium, the revenue impact that Kyle assigns to the bill will go into what is called the close of session forecast. So if it's a $35 million a year impact increase, what happens is all of the legislative actions that get taken this biennium get combined and basically get added to the May forecast that you heard last month. And the sum of those two numbers becomes what is known as the close of session forecast, and that is the baseline for the kicker. So the potential impact on the kicker is just whatever the difference is between the estimate on the impact and then whatever the impact actually is. But compared to the size of the budget, it's pretty much rounding error. If you look at a $20 billion budget and a $30 million tax change here.
But to be clear, there's no impact on the kicker that we're anticipating from this biennium. Is that correct?
Correct, Madam Chair. The current kicker that we're expecting now, the accounting period for that kicker ends in a few weeks, ends on June 30th. Mm-hmm. So there is no change to the pass-through program that is going to affect tax collections over the next 3 weeks. The question will be if it's effective beginning on tax year 21 or tax year 22, and that's purely a timing for how much gets incorporated into the 21-23 biennium for that baseline kicker. So in short, no effect on the current kicker. It gets embedded in the baseline for the next kicker. I said that as if there is a next kicker.
For the next forecast.
for the next biennium's baseline to see. Yeah. I don't have any information that there's going to be a kicker next biennium, just to be perfectly clear.
Thank you. Senator Finley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I assume you probably know what my question is going to be. Is if we're taking an action, and I'm thinking about the definition from Legislative Council a couple of months ago, if we take an action that increases revenue to our state, which this would do by removing or changing the criteria for this program, would it require 3/5 vote by the chambers to do so?
Legislative Council has indicated this is not a 3/5. And in fact, the only while it does change rates, it lowers the rates that get changed. But in the advice we've gotten from Leg Council is that because it's not increasing any tax rates, it's not a 3/5, even despite it having a positive revenue impact.
Hmm. Okay. I thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you. And there's been litigation around this, and so it's pretty settled law on this, and it is confusing, but that we're very clear that it's not a 3/5.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I just wanted to be sure, because I'm putting together my end-of-the-week newsletter. Mr. Alanak did promise a kicker in the next biennium. Is that what I understand? I appreciate it. Sorry, Madam Co-Chair. We need levity on a Friday afternoon.
I certainly agree with Representative Smith. Tragic though it is from some people's standpoint.
Right.
Okay. Are there other questions from the committee? And again, this information is on the information meeting materials for this meeting. So, and we will be having a public hearing on Senate Bill 139 with probably I believe it's the -7 amendment we'll be talking about, Chris, primarily on that. So I invite you all to tune in on that as well. So that completes our work for the committee today. Representative Nathanson, Co-Chair Nathanson, do you have any parting thoughts?
No, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I should mention that at our meeting yesterday, we were really pressed for time. We had a very full agenda. There were a few slides that we had not been able to review with Mr. Alanak, but we understood they were available for us to study. I'm not sure if any of the members had questions about those, and we can always cover them at another meeting.
Thank you. All right, that completes our meeting. I hope everybody has a wonderful weekend. It's beautiful weather out there, I think, everywhere. So with that, we are adjourned.
Have a wonderful weekend. Bye, gang.